was put together prior to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans in 70 AD, with the exception of five books that were written by the Apostle John. These books were written at a much later time, approximately 20 to 30 years after all of the rest of the New Testament had been completed. Now, by the time the destruction of Jerusalem came in 70 AD, nearly all of the first century church membership was dead, the overwhelming majority, certainly of the leadership. Virtually all the apostles, the Apostle James, the brother of Jesus, was martyred in Jerusalem by the Jews in the somewhere around 64 AD, and around the mid-60s. And about 3 to 4 years later, the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Peter were martyred in Rome. Paul probably right at the end of 67, Paul at the beginning of 68, in the final year of Nero's reign. So we see that the New Testament, the leadership of the New Testament, that first generation of leadership had passed from the scene. The Apostle John lived on far beyond any of the others. We know specifically that the time of his exile on Patmos, that's a matter, there's a secular historical record that this took place in the reign of the Emperor Domitian, and this would put it in the 90s A.D. Now my question is, when you look at the Gospel of John, you look at a Gospel that is in many ways very different from the other three. There were already, when John wrote in the final decade of the first century, there were already three Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke. John comes along and writes another Gospel account. Writes a fourth book. He wrote three epistles as well as the book of Revelation. Now, John was obviously, you know, when 20, 25, 30 years pass, you've got different people on the scene, different events. There are a lot of things that circumstances are different. John wrote for a specific reason. Now, everybody, all of you in Spokesman's Club or who have been through Spokesman's Club are very familiar with what we mean when we talk about an SPS, a specific purpose statement. Well, I'm going to show you in a few minutes, John had an SPS in the book of John. He's got a very clear SPS. He didn't put it where you would normally expect to find it, but he put it there. It's very clear. He put it in the Gospel of John. He also restated it in 1 John. Now, sort of set the stage a little bit in terms of what has happened. We know that the books of 1 and 2 Thessalonians were at least among the first books written in the New Testament. Certainly seem to be among the very earliest of Paul's epistles. Would normally be dated, I think most sources agree, somewhere around 50 A.D. I won't go through the details of the book of Acts and show you how we come up with that date. But they would certainly be among the earliest books of the New Testament. Yet Paul writes in 2 Thessalonians, you know that problems are going on in the New Testament church, because he writes in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that the mystery of iniquity is already working. That mystery of iniquity, the mystery religion that proclaims lawlessness, that was already at work in the very early 50s. By a few years later, Paul, writing in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, addresses the fact that there were false apostles, that there were those who were preaching another Jesus and another spirit and another gospel. Now, he addresses that in 2 Corinthians 11. Here we are, let's say, in the mid-50s. So here we find ourselves 20, 25 years after the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and there were already false teachings that were beginning to be promulgated. There was this system, this mystery of iniquity was already at work. This false doctrines were already being taught. Come on about 10 years after 2 Corinthians was written, in the book of Jude, the Apostle Jude exhorted those who were his readers to contend earnestly for the faith once and for all delivered, And then he talked about how certain men were crept in unawares, ungodly men, men who were seeking to turn the grace of God into lawlessness. So again, we come to this concept of turning grace into lawlessness, this mystery of iniquity, of sin, of lawlessness. So Jude made it apparent that this movement that had been alluded to maybe 15 years earlier in 2 Thessalonians was gaining momentum. And at this point, he was urging people to earnestly contend for what had once and for all been delivered, because they were in danger of losing it. Peter, writing in 2 Peter, probably shortly after Jude had written, 2 Peter chapter 1, Peter emphasizes the fact that he, in 2 Peter 1:12, did not want, he was not going to be negligent. He wanted to put them always in remembrance of these things. He knew that they knew it right then. They had been established, but he wanted them to have a permanent record. He said in 2 Peter 1:13, "I think it fitting, as long as I'm in this tabernacle, to stir you up by putting you in remembrance." He said, "I know I'm not going to live much longer. I'm going to put off this, my tabernacle, just like the Lord Jesus showed me. I want to endeavor that you may be able, after my decease, to have these things always in remembrance." So he was putting together a permanent record. Undoubtedly, what we would term the first canon of the New Testament Scriptures. The canon, well, there are 27 books in the New Testament, five of which were written by John, so I think it's very likely that it was the others, the 22 books that Peter put together, because he was endeavoring that after he was gone, after he was dead, they would have these things always in remembrance. They would know. And in verse 16, he makes a switch. It seems like virtually none of the commentators really focus on this. But in verse 12, 13, 14, and 15, he's saying, "I," first person singular, "I will not be negligent. I think it me. I must put off this, my tabernacle. I will endeavor." But in verse 16, he switches to first person plural. "For we have not followed cunningly devised fables when we made known unto you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received from God the Father honor and glory. When there came such a voice to him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased,' this voice which came from heaven, we heard when we were with him in the Holy Mount." Now, who is the we? Peter says, "I want you to have a permanent record. We have not followed cunningly devised fables. We were with him in the Holy Mount. We were eyewitnesses." Well, Matthew 17 establishes clearly who the we is, because Matthew 17:1 tells us that after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and he brought them up into a high mountain apart and was transfigured before them. His face did shine as the sun, and his raiment as white as the light. As we come on down, we find that they were overshadowed by a bright cloud. Verse 5, "A voice out of the cloud said, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear you him.'" Now, this remarkable event is what Peter makes reference to in 2 Peter chapter 1. He said, "We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. We heard the voice that said, 'This is my beloved Son.'" We know that Jesus took three men with him: Peter, James, and John. James and John, the brothers. Well, as you go through the book of Acts, Acts chapter 12 shows that James, the brother of John, was the very first of the 12 apostles to be martyred. He was put to death by Herod. And that was in the early period of the New Testament church. So from that time on, only two out of the three witnesses survived: Peter and John. Here is Peter at the end of his life, shortly before his death, and he makes reference to we who were eyewitnesses of his majesty. That is Peter and John. Then Peter makes his point in verse 19 of 2 Peter 1, verse 19, "We have also a more sure word of prophecy, whereunto you do well that you take heed. We have the sure word of prophecy. John and I, we were eyewitnesses of His Majesty. We were there in the Holy Mount. We heard the voice from heaven saying, "This is My beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." We have a sure word of prophecy. So Peter puts together the initial canon of the New Testament. He wants them to have a permanent record of the truth. By this time, people are having to earnestly contend. There are all sorts of false ideas going around. So Peter wants to ensure that there is an authentic record of what Jesus Himself said and did and taught, and what His immediate personal followers said and did and taught. Now, within a couple of years of Peter's death, the Jerusalem church had to flee. Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. Virtually all of that first generation of leadership was dead. Most of the first generation of Christians were dead. The years go on. A couple of decades pass. We come into the final decade of the first century. And at this point, the Apostle John takes up his pen and writes. And he is addressing and setting the stage for something different. Because there are the circumstances on the scene have changed. Before we get more into that, let me just show you one thing here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, you know there were primarily two segments of the early New Testament church. That was Jews and Greeks. Or Gentiles, primarily Greek speaking. Now, Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 22, "For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God, the source of signs and wonders, and the wisdom of God." But he said the Jews require a sign. They're always looking for a sign. The Greeks won't argue. They're looking for wisdom. They want something that's logical and reasonable and makes sense. And they like to speculate and discuss and get philosophical. Now, by the time we come to the end of the first century, John is addressing both the Jewish segment and the Greek segment of the church. And there were different problems that were confronting each group. The Jewish, the problems in Judea did not end with the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That was catastrophic, and that destroyed the temple, but there was something even more catastrophic that occurred later. It came to a head about 135 AD. It's called the Second Jewish Revolt, or the Bar Kokhba revolt. This fellow by the name of Bar Kokhba, there in Judea, basically proclaimed himself as the Messiah, was acknowledged as such by a number of the rabbis and some of the Jewish religious leaders, and led a revolt against the Romans that resulted in massive destruction and loss of life to the Jews. If you've heard about the siege at Masada, that's the time period at which it occurred. The end of the Second Jewish Revolt. Now, there were a couple of things that happened in the aftermath of the Second Jewish Revolt. One is that for Jerusalem, the Roman emperors attempted to prohibit any sort of Jewish presence there in the future. But there were a couple of interesting things that happened right around that time. One was, of course, what happened with the Second Jewish Revolt. But we find historically that it was in the aftermath of that that the date of the first Easter service in Rome is dated in the late 130s. We know the date because we have actually a writing from one of the bishops of Rome, from Victor, Bishop of Rome, who specifically says that the tradition he observed in terms of Easter Sunday dated from his predecessor Sixtus, and he gives the the time, you see, that it started. And when you look at it historically, then that was the 130s. So there was a complete divergence. We find a massive destruction and shattering of the Jewish community. We find the false teachings in terms of the law, as well as the fact that it was in the second century that all of these ideas that developed into the Trinity, that developed from a Greek philosophical school called Neoplatonism, that was sort of a rerun of old Plato, you know, who had been back several centuries earlier, then you come along, you have the Neoplatonists, and they came up with their ideas, which even the Catholic Encyclopedia will admit that was the backdrop, that was the sort of the source of much of the early Catholic teaching from dating from the 2nd and 3rd centuries about the Trinity. So here is John writing at the end of the 1st century. And these events are on the horizon within a relatively short time, within 35 years of this, these things will have occurred, will have happened. So John writes to stress certain things. And let's go back to the Gospel of John. Here, John chapter 20. I want to show you, to start with, John's SPS. John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. John says, "And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written, that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life through his name." Now, within a matter of 3 decades, there were an awful lot of Jews who were going to be caught up in believing that a man by the name of Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. And they followed him to the death. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews perished. It had a terrible effect. Now, Paul had said earlier, you know, the Jews are seeking after a sign. We're going to see that in the Gospel of John, he specifically enumerates 7 signs. Seven signs. And he says, now there are a lot of others I could have told you about, but these signs, there are many other signs that he did that aren't written in this book, but these are written, the specific 7 that John lists, these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Not somebody else. Jesus is the Messiah. That you might believe that. And that you might believe that he is the Son of God. And if you believe, truly believe, that will lead you to life through his name. Those who believe the wrong things, who went off chasing false messiahs, who went off into all sorts of crazy ideas that originated in Greek philosophy, you know, they lost sight of who and what is God and what it meant to be the Son of God and come up with all sorts of crazy things. So you find that John is going to stress something, going to emphasize something that's very important. Now, let's go back here in the Gospel of John. Let's notice how John opens. In John chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." One of the things to recognize here, the Greek word, of course, is logos, that is translated word. If you look up in some of the commentaries and read a little bit about it, you find that logos was a popular term in Greek philosophical thought. This played a big role, and the Greek philosophers wrote about logos, and they had all their ideas and their concepts. And a lot of it, what was called Neoplatonism, really went back to Plato. You know, he was the source of some of that. And Plato, the whole idea that the Greeks had was that by proper reasoning, by proper logic, you could always arrive at the truth. Now, of course, the trouble with that is, I think anybody who's ever taken geometry, hopefully one lesson that they've learned is that no matter how good your logic is, if you start from a faulty premise, you're going to be in trouble. Logic can become simply the correct way to be wrong. You know, if you start from a faulty premise. Now, Plato, in his writings, which serve as the source of a lot of this stuff, Plato describes this scene of a fella sitting in a cave, and all he can see is the shadows on the wall. And Plato sort of reasons everything. It's incredible the stuff he can come up with from some guy sitting there watching shadows on a wall. And that's sort of the way he figures this out. And he goes through and he comes up to all these conclusions. And this is hot stuff as far as a lot of these Greeks are concerned. They think that, you know, they really got something. And the term, you know, they thought they knew, they speculated about all this, and they had all their logic and their reasoning. And the Logos served, that was a big part of some of this that the Greeks talked about. Now, John starts out, you see, he's ultimately, the Jews were seeking after a sign, and the Greeks were seeking after wisdom. John says, now, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. Now, if you're in a cave, and all you can see is sort of shadows on the wall, John says, look, I'm not talking about, you know, you're sort of sitting in a cave and you can't see much, sort of see a few shadows on the wall. We're talking about light. The true light, see, as he comes on down. It talks about in verse 9, that was the true light which lights every man that comes into the world. Now, I'm talking about light, John says. You want the Logos? I'm going to tell you about the Logos, the one who was with God, who was in the beginning with God, who was God, who is the instrument of creation. In Him was life and light. And that light shines into the darkness, and the darkness doesn't have a clue. Can't comprehend it. Light and darkness, you know, they can't coexist in the same place. So John starts out, he's going to tell them, you see, ultimately, real wisdom points to Jesus Christ. Now, John goes on in John 1, verse 6, he says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John, speaking of John the Baptist. The same came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. So John starts out talking about believing. By the time you get to verse 7, we find there is an emphasis on believing. That's what he said right at the end of the book. In fact, it's interesting, you know, John uses the word believe more than all the rest of the writers of the New Testament added together. Just in the Gospel of John alone, he uses the word 99 times. When you add in all the places in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, John used the word believe many times more than all the rest of the writers added together. He says, John the Baptist came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. He was not the light, but he was sent to bear witness of the light. The true light that lights every man that comes into the world. He was in the world, speaking of Jesus. He was in the world, the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name. Verse 14 tells us, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, verse 18, no man has seen God, God the Father. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he's declared him. So, the Greek could reason all day long about their cave and the shadows in the cave and all the things that they thought they could figure out. And John says, we don't have shadows in a cave, we've got light. It came right from God and is God and was made flesh. And dwelt among us. And he's declared the Father. And he knows all about the Father because he was in the bosom of the Father. He was right there in an intimate relationship with the Father. And he says, I know what I'm talking about because I was there. Now, we've just read this in the Gospel of John. Let's go back to 1 John. Let me show you something. I think it is very clear when you read the opening of 1 John to realize the order in which John wrote his books. I think the Gospel of John clearly had to have been the first of the books that he wrote, and I think that's proven by 1 John chapter 1. Because John, in the Gospel of John, goes into and describes in detail certain things of really expounding the concept of the Word and the light and the true light, and he goes through. Now notice how he opens in 1 John 1, verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked upon, which our hands have handled of the Word of life. The life was manifested, and we've seen it, and bear witness, and show unto you that eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. Now, here John introduces that from the beginning he introduces the Word, he introduces life, he introduces coming from the Father and being manifested, and then he starts talking about dwelling in the light. On down here in verses 5 and 6 and 7. Clearly, John is drawing on the same expressions, the same terms that he defined and expounded upon in the Gospel of John. In other words, if you have read the Gospel of John, and now you read 1 John, the allusions that John makes to the Word and the light and all of this make sense because you just got through reading John chapter 1 and you know what all that's talking about. If you read 1 John 1 and had never seen the Gospel of John, he's introducing a lot of concepts that he's not explaining. So I think from that standpoint, it's pretty clear that he wrote the Gospel of John. Now, a little later, he writes 1 John. And he picks up on the terms that he used. Realize John is the only one who used that term, the Word, to refer to Jesus. He uses it in the Gospel of John. He uses it in 1 John. He uses it in the book of Revelation. Paul never uses that. Matthew, Mark, Luke, they don't use that. You know, John uses that term, and he expounds it most fully in chapter 1 of the Gospel of John. Now, he comes on through here developing this theme in 1 John. By the time you get to the end of 1 John, chapter 5, 1 John chapter 5 and verse 11, this is the record that God has given unto us eternal life, and this life is in His Son. He that has the Son has life, he that has not the Son of God has not life. These things have I written unto you that believe on the name of the Son of God, that you may know that you have eternal life, and that you may believe on the name of the Son of God. So He's SPS right here. See, this is why I wrote this. Told you in the Gospel of John, he tells you in 1 John why he wrote it, and it's very similar. He says, I want you to know certain things. I want you to believe on the Son of God. He said in John chapter 20, I have a lot of signs that Christ did, but the ones I've told you I have recorded so that you might know that Jesus is the Messiah and that He's the Son of God. And because He's the Son of God, because He was in the beginning with God, was God, was made flesh and dwelt among us, He has declared the Father, so we know all about God. We know it from a first-hand source. We didn't look at shadows on a cave wall somewhere and sort of figure it out. We have the light. You know, that's a pretty good source. If He was God, was with God, was made flesh, dwelt among us, declared the Father, and John says, you know, I was an eyewitness. Of course, Peter, writing 25 years earlier, said, you know, John and I are the ones that have the sure word of prophecy. You do well to take heed to us. You know, we were with Him in the Holy Mount. We saw His glory. We heard the voice from heaven. We are eyewitnesses of His majesty. Now, I mentioned seven signs. You know, John, there's so much packed in the Gospel of John. John was clearly a person who thought about things. He was not, I'll show you a little bit of that as we come on a little later. John reflected and he thought about things. He was not someone that just jumped in. Peter was in some ways had more outward leadership qualities, and Christ used him as the leader of the 12. But Peter was impulsive and he would jump right in there. John was not as quick on some of those things. He would think about it and ponder it. But John reflected and had very deep insight. And Anyway, we'll come to that as we come on through. Now, in John chapter 2, we pick up the story at the marriage feast in Cana. And Jesus is there along with his disciples. And what we find, this was just prior to the beginning of his public ministry. Jesus had been baptized by John the Baptist in the fall, had disappeared into the Judean wilderness for a period of weeks. He fasted for 40 days during that time. He was tempted of the devil, and in the aftermath of that, had come back, had regained his strength, and had called out disciples and had was teaching them. Now, he's at a wedding feast in Cana, and a short time later, he came to Jerusalem at the Passover. So the events occurred between the Feast of Tabernacles in 27 A.D. and the Passover of 28, which was the Passover of 28 A.D. was the beginning of his public ministry. And he did, that's where he fulfilled the prophecy made in Malachi 3, of the Lord whom you seek will come suddenly to his temple. That is described when you read John 2. He did come suddenly and he cleaned house. That's when he cast out money changers and created quite a stir. It gave everybody something to talk about for a pretty good while to come. Now, he had not, at the wedding feast in Cana, he had not yet begun his public ministry. But he and his disciples were there, and his mother came to him and told him, they've run out of wine. And Jesus said, well, what do you want me to do about it? My hour is not yet come. It's not yet the time for me to make a public display. That was what he was going to do just probably a couple of weeks later, a few weeks later there in Jerusalem. Well, we don't know the connection. We don't know who was getting married. It must have been somebody who was probably connected to the family of Jesus, because his mother clearly had stature there, because she turned to the servants and said, look, whatever he tells you, do it. Well, obviously she had stature among them, because they did. And what he asked them to do was a pretty strange thing. There were some pots sitting over there. There were six big water pots of stone mentioned in verse 6 that were used for purifying by the Jews to hold water. And they would hold quite a bit of water. And Jesus told the servants, see, his mother told the servants, she says, you do whatever he says. So after she left, or maybe she was still standing there, he turned to the servants and he said, I'll tell you what, go, you see those pots over there? Go fill them with water. Fill them to the brim. So they did. And then he said, I want you to draw out some of the water and take it to the governor of the feast. Now, if you were one of those servants, that must have struck you as sort of, wait a minute. He's expecting wine, and I'm going to bring him a glass of water. I don't know if he's going to be real happy when I show up with that. They've got this big feast going on. But she said, follow his instructions. So they said, all right, So they drew it out and went bringing it up there, and he gave it to the governor of the feast, and the governor of the feast took a drink. He said, boy, this is good stuff. He turned to the bridegroom, and he said, most folks, when they have a wedding feast, the best wine they have is what they serve right at the beginning after people have been eating and drinking for a while. Well, they sort of move on down, They run through the good stuff and they just have some of this other left. But he says, you save the best to last. So not only did Christ make wine, he made good wine. Now, notice verse 11 of John 2. This beginning of miracles. The literal, let me mention at this point, there are actually three different words in the New Testament that refer to miracles. One literally means a miracle. It would be the most literal translation, a miracle or a wonder, some marvelous thing. A second word refers to power. It's the word dunamos. It's the word we get our word dynamic and dynamo from. It refers to power. And some great, of course, a miracle involves power, so it's not like it's a mistranslation, but it's just that there's a problem in that you have three distinct Greek words that are often translated by the same English word, and so you lose the distinction. There's a third word, and the third word is used here, and it's a word that John uses more than all of the other writers of the New Testament. And it is the word for sign. And it, in this context, refers to a miraculous sign. It doesn't have to mean a miraculous sign. It can mean, it can just mean sign, just like our English word sign. And so it can be a miraculous sign or it can be an ordinary sign. It just depends on the context. Clearly, in this context, it was a miraculous sign. This beginning of signs did Jesus in Cana of Galilee. Now, sort of the connection, you see, the Jews sought after a sign, Paul says. At the end of John, he talks about these signs. Well, this is the beginning of the signs. Not necessarily the first thing that Jesus ever did in a miraculous way. Mary certainly knew that he could. You know, we don't know. You know, there's no point in speculating about what he had done before in a private context. But this was the beginning of the signs. This beginning of signs did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. So what was the result of this sign? This was the beginning of the signs. And the sign resulted in his disciples beginning to believe on him. Now, as you come on down through the story, we know that there are a lot of other miracles and miraculous signs that Jesus performed because a little later at the Passover, this is the story of when he came in and cleansed the temple, and the Jews ask him in verse 18, the religious leaders, "What sign do you show unto us that you've done all these things?" What's the sign? Well, Jesus answered and he said unto them, "Destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up." Well, that was sort of an enigmatic statement. They didn't understand what he meant. You remember back in Matthew, it was stated a little more clearly. He said it in slightly different ways, but he was referring to the same thing. He said, in Matthew, the way it's quoted, he says, "This is an evil and adulterous generation, and there will no sign be given to it except for the sign of the prophet Jonah. Just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the heart of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." So they ask him, and he said, that's the sign I'm going to give you. Destroy this temple," referring, of course, to the temple of his body. "In 3 days, I'll raise it up." Well, they said they couldn't figure out what he was talking about, and thought he was talking about the temple of Herod. But notice here in verse 23, "He was in Jerusalem in the Passover and the feast day. Many believed in his name when they saw the miracles." And again, the word is sign. When they saw the signs that he did. So he did a lot of signs. We don't know what specifically they were, but Nicodemus, who was a Pharisee, member of the Sanhedrin, came to him privately by night, here probably during the days of unleavened bread, as he was preaching and teaching in the temple every day and performing these various signs, and he said, "Rabbi, we know you're a teacher come from God, for no man can do these signs," again, that's the word, "these signs that you do except God be with him." So he was working signs and they saw it. But if you continue on down, we're not told any specifics of what he did until after the Passover season, and he went back through Samaria going north to Galilee, and he came there to Nazareth for Pentecost, was there in the synagogue Pentecost the first year of his ministry. And he had come back to Cana, which was another nearby little town. And when he came there, we're told in verse 46, "A certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum," which was nearby. When this nobleman heard that Jesus had come from Judea north up to Galilee, he went to him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And Jesus said unto him, "Except you see signs and wonders, you won't believe." And the nobleman said unto him, "Sir, please come. My son's going to die." And Jesus said, "Go your way. Your son lives." And the man believed the word of Jesus. You notice the emphasis here in connection, how John emphasizes this belief. You know, the disciples saw a sign and they believed. This man received Jesus' word and he believed what Jesus said. And he went his way. And on his way, some of his servants met him, and they said, hey, your son is well, he's doing a whole lot better, he's fine. The nobleman asked the servants, he said, tell me, when did my son start getting better? When did he get well? And they said, well, yesterday, you know, it was just about this particular time, and all of a sudden the fever broke. The nobleman said, yes, that's when he spoke the word. Now, notice verse 54. This is again the second sign. That's the word. This is again the second sign that Jesus did when he was come out of Judea and into Galilee. Now, we know he'd already worked a number of other signs. But John isn't trying to record all the signs. That's what he says at the end of John 20, right? He says, now, he did a lot of others. And I'm not writing about those. I'm writing these that you might know that Jesus is the Messiah. I want to show you there's a significance to the seven that John picked out. The first one was turning water into wine. The second one was healing the nobleman's son. It's numbered here. This is the second sign that he did. Well, as you come on down a little further, in chapter 5, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And the context is the fall festivals. And there was a crippled man. A man who was powerless to use his limbs, at least his legs, called here the impotent man, a man lacking in strength and power in his legs, and he was crippled. He couldn't move, and he was lying here on a bed, and Jesus saw him there lying in verse 6, and he talked with him for a little bit, and he says, do you want to be made whole? Do you want to be restored to strength and power? And then Jesus told him in verse 8, rise, take up your bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole. You know, these little shriveled, crippled limbs, we're not told exactly what the problem is, but it was obvious. I mean, you just look. He was made whole, and he took up his bed and walked. The same day was the Sabbath. Well, the Jews got all upset because he was carrying his bed. I think it's good to put that in context. This was not a Sealy posturpedic that he was hauling around on his back, you know, and about to collapse under carrying, you know, all the... This was like a sleeping bag or a little quilt, a little bedroll. So, but the Jews got all upset, and, you know, they began to lecture this fellow and said, you know, it's not lawful for you to carry the bed. And he said, well, I tell you what, why don't you go take that argument up with the fellow that made me whole? He's the one that told me to take it up. He told me to stand up, and I stood up. And he told me to take the bed and take that with me, and so I did that too. Well, we find that the Jews were, you know, they were upset, and we find that the Jews sought to persecute Jesus because of this. It mentions here in verse 16. In fact, later on, when you get later at the Feast of Tabernacles in 30 AD, they were still remembering and talking about this and were still upset about Christ having told this fellow to take up his bedroll. Now, as we come on down a little further, you get into chapter 6, and it's the Passover season is near. By the way, in John chapter 6, we're going to read here of the feeding of the 5,000. Do you realize that is the only miraculous sign that Jesus performed that is recorded in all four Gospels? John chapter 9, the events of the last great day in the fall of 30 AD, the final 6 months of Jesus' ministry. We find, again, it was on the Sabbath that Jesus healed a blind man, told him to go and wash in the pool of Siloam, and this man went and washed, and he received his sight. He was made blind. He was blind, and he was now able to see. And Jesus had made the clay and opened his eyes on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees got all upset, and they said, well, this man is a sinner. And verse 16, others said, Well, how can a man that's a sinner do such signs? That's the word. And there was a division among them. And there, some of them even disputed whether or not the man was, had been born blind, but that was easily proven. Now, if you've been counting, this is our fifth sign that is mentioned. The water turned to wine at the wedding feast, the healing of the nobleman's son, the restoring of strength and power to the impotent man's legs. Now, the the feeding of the 5,000, multiplying of the loaves and the fishes, and now this fifth sign is the blind man who's now able to see. As we come on a little further in John chapter 11, we come to the event that was the most remarkable miracle that Jesus performed during the 3.5 years of his ministry. The most remarkable thing that he did during his human ministry prior to his crucifixion and resurrection. And the story is here in John chapter 11 about Martha and Mary, the sisters, and their brother Lazarus. And Lazarus got sick, and they sent word to Jesus, and Jesus delayed. And then finally, after he knew that this was long enough, Lazarus would have died, he told the disciples, come on, let's go. And Jesus told them, verse 14, that Lazarus is dead. Notice verse 15. And I'm glad for your sake that I wasn't there, to the intent that you may believe. That you may believe. Let's go. So they went, and they came there, and Martha told Jesus, she came out to meet him, and verse 21, she said, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. I know that. And I know that even now, whatever you will ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said unto her, your brother will rise again. And she said, well, I know about the resurrection. I believe in that. And Jesus said, well, I'm the resurrection and the life. He that believes on me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? And she said, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, that should come into the world. So she gave record of that. John says this is the reason he recorded the signs, is the specific ones that he did, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. Martha said, I believe that. I believe you're the Messiah, the Son of God. So she went and called Mary, and they came out there, and you remember the story. Down in verse 43, Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth. He made him open the tomb, and he said, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus came walking out. In verse 45, many of the Jews which came to Mary had seen the things which Jesus did, they believed on him. Some of them went and told the Pharisees. They got together with the chief priests, formed a council. In verse 47, they said, what are we going to do? This man does many signs. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him. And the Romans will come and take away our place in our nation. This brings us right down. The Passover was getting close. And John chapter 12 picks up the story at the Passover. Now, Jesus, of course, was arrested on the evening after the Passover. He was given a mockery of a trial and taken and crucified. John 19 records that. Records his death. Records that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took his body and buried him very quickly because the it was the preparation day for the holy day. It was the Passover, which was the preparation for the first day of unleavened bread. And so they buried him close by. He didn't have much time. And as soon as the women had the opportunity, you can go to the other gospel accounts. You know, after the Sabbath was passed, they bought sweet spices after the holy day. Then they prepared them. Then they rested on the Sabbath day according to the commandment. And so early Sunday morning, just as soon as it began to get a little bit light, they came to the tomb. They were coming to embalm the body. When they got there, of course, they found out that it was empty. And Mary Magdalene came running back, and she came running, chapter 20, verse 2, to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. Speaking of John, John identifies himself finally in the last part of the book. She came there to Peter and John, and she said, "They've taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we don't know where they've laid Him." So she didn't come saying, you know, Jesus has been resurrected. She said, the grave is empty. Somebody's stolen the body. We don't know what's happened. Well, Peter, therefore, went forth, and that other disciple, and came to the disciple. They came to the sepulchre. They both ran together, and the other disciple did outrun Peter. Came first to the sepulchre. You know, here old John was 90 years old, and he was remembering back all those years. He said, you know, I outran Peter. We raced out of Jerusalem, and I beat him there. I outran him. Sort of, you know, certain things stand out in your mind. You remember. John remembered that. But notice, this is interesting. He outran Peter, got there, came first to the sepulchre, stooped down. He looked in, and he saw the linen clothes. Why? But he didn't go in. Peter came following after him. You know, he was huffing and puffing up from the rear. And when he got there, he went barreling right on into the sepulchre. And he saw the linen clothes lying there. And the napkin that was about his head, not lying with the linen clothes, but wrapped together in a place by itself. Then went in also that other disciple, which came first to the sepulchre. And he saw and believed. It's interesting, John was evidently the first one to believe the resurrection. You know, John stopped and thought about it. He looked in, he stopped at the doorway and just stared. And it was empty, and the clothes were wrapped up. By the way, this simple account disproves the Shroud of Turin. There are a lot of things that disprove the Shroud of Turin. This simple account proves it. If you've ever seen a picture of the Shroud of Turin, it's one long cloth, you know, head to foot. Well, according to John, chapter 20, Jesus wasn't wrapped with one cloth. There was a separate cloth that wrapped his head and another one that wrapped his body. And actually, they were wound around anyway. But John makes it very plain. You know, the one that was around his head was laying up here and the other one was there. You know, Jesus was neat. He folded it up. When he left them folded, that's what it says here. It was wrapped together in a place by itself. And John stood there looking in. Peter came running in, rushed in, and saw all this stuff. But John just sort of stopped, and he looked at it, and he thought about it. And then after Peter had gone in, he stepped in too, and he looked at it, and hid it. He believed. He knew what had happened. He believed what Jesus had said. He believed. Now, as they come on back, they went back to their home, and Mary stood out crying. And again, remember, it hadn't really hit her what had happened yet. And we come on down a little later. The disciples were gathered together, and Jesus stood in their midst. He just appeared there, and Thomas was not present when that occurred. And then 8 days later, they were together again, and Thomas was with them when Jesus appeared there, right in the midst of the room. Now, in the meantime, in this interval, this week, the others have been telling Thomas what happened. The Lord is raised. He's raised from the dead. He's alive. We saw him. He appeared. Thomas said, "I don't believe it. I wouldn't believe it unless I could put my finger in the holes in his hand. Unless I could stick my fist in his side." You see, John records in John 19:34 that one of the soldiers with a spear had pierced his side. And blood and water had poured out. You know, the corpse was all the blood poured out. Thomas said, "You know, he's dead. I saw him. I saw his dead body. I saw that gaping hole in his side where you could stick your hand in there. I don't believe he's alive." Well, of course, Jesus appeared there in the midst, and he said, the first thing he said, "Thomas, come here. I understand you want to stick your hand, your finger in my hand. Here it is. And while you're at it, why don't you stick your arm in my side? Thomas, we're told, answered, verse 28, and said, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said, "I don't want you to be faithless. I want you to believe. I want you believing." Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." Now, Jesus did a lot of other things, verse 30. Many other signs, truly, did Jesus in the presence of His disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, that He's the Son of God, and believe that you might have life. You know, the Messiah was the only one who could meet Israel's needs, who could meet the needs of His people. The signs John reported, the Messiah was able to provide joy. He turned the water into wine. Here was a festival. Here was a joyous occasion. The Messiah could bring joy. The Messiah could heal the sick child. He could bring health and healing. The Messiah could restore strength and power to a man whose legs were empty. The Messiah could feed the 5,000. He could multiply the bread and the fish. He was the one who could offer nourishment and food to His people. The Messiah was the one who could give sight to the blind. He could give life to dead Lazarus. And the Messiah came out of that tomb alive, not just alive like Lazarus was, but alive in power and glory. Alive forevermore. He had died and had triumphed over death. He could offer life to Israel. You see, the signs of the Messiah that are recorded focus in on the needs that the Messiah could meet. Now, John says there's a lot of other things that He did, but I single these out for a specific reason, because I want you to know that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the one and the only one who can meet all the needs. John explained many things through here about Jesus Christ and how He was the Word and how He was made manifest and how He declared the Father. Let me show you something else. Back in 1 John chapter 5. Verses 7 and 8, I think all of you understand that there is in the King James and in several of the English translations, there is an interpolation here referring to the Trinity that was never part of the original text. Any good commentary will bring that out. But let's notice that what we often focus in on what 1 John 5, 7 doesn't say. But let's notice what 1 John 5, 7 and 8 do say. For there are three that bear witness: the Spirit, and the water, and the blood. And these three agree in one. If you receive the witness of men, the witness of God is greater. For this is the witness of God, which He has testified of His Son. He that believes on the Son of God has the witness in himself. He that believes not God has made him a liar, because he believes not the record that God gave of His Son. How did God provide three witnesses? You know, the Old Testament says in the mouth of two or three witnesses, the thing is established. John says, you know, you don't just have the witness of man, you have the specific witness of God. The specific witness of God involving Spirit, water, and blood, which is, God's witness is a greater witness than any human witness, but you have the specific witness of God, three specific witnesses, the witness of Spirit, the witness of water, and the witness of blood, that testify that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, what does that mean? Well, go back to the Gospel of John. Let me show you something. John chapter 1, we'll pick it up in verse 29. The next day, John, speaking of John the Baptist, sees Jesus coming unto him, and he says, "Behold, the Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world." This is he of whom I said, after me comes a man that is preferred before me, that was before me. And I knew him not. But that he should be made manifest to Israel, therefore I am come baptizing with water. And John bore record, saying, I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and it abode upon him. And I knew him not, but he that sent me to baptize with water, the same said unto me, upon whom you shall see the Spirit descending and remaining on him, the same is he that baptizes with the Holy Spirit. I saw and bore record that this is the Son of God. God says that he bore witness through the Spirit. Now, John the Baptist was prophesying and was preaching. John the Baptist would not recognize Jesus. They had either never seen one another or perhaps only since infancy or childhood. John had grown up a shepherd, would not have recognized Jesus on the street. But God had revealed to him, the same one that told him to baptize, God told, you know, and inspired him and that he was to go out and baptize and preach a message of repentance. And God had also inspired him to know that when you see, you know, I want you to point out the Messiah. And in fact, John the Baptist said, well, Lord, how will I know who he is? And God says, I will bear witness to him. You baptize. And the time is going to come when there's going to be somebody there that you baptize, that a dove is going to come down from heaven. My Spirit, in the shape of a dove, is going to come down and alight on it. And that will identify it. This is the one. And so John told that story. He said, you know, I knew him not, verse 31. But I was told that I would see the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove. I didn't know him, verse 33. But I was told that when you see that, that is the one. So God bore witness. Now let's come on back here in John a little further. In John chapter 5, or John chapter 6, rather. We saw about the feeding of the 5,000. Now, in the aftermath of this particular sign that Jesus did, this feeding of the 5,000, Jesus himself sort of got away from the crowd and went up to a mountain to pray, but he had instructed the disciples, when sunset comes, if I'm not back, you guys get in the boat and go to Capernaum and I'll meet you there. And so they did. And it was dark, and they started out across the lake, and it got stormy. And the storm blew, and the wind blew, and they rowed and rowed, and it was taking them all night. And verse 19, while they were rowing, they looked up, and they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near to the ship, and they were afraid. He said, you know, it's all right, don't be afraid. Well, just hold your spot there. Let's turn back to Matthew 14. Matthew gives a detailed account of the same event. Now, as you notice here, we find that verse 24 of Matthew 14, the ship was in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, the wind was contrary, and here it was the fourth watch of the night. It was getting late, getting toward dawn. And Jesus came unto them walking on the sea. And the disciples saw him walking on the sea. They were troubled, scared them to death. They thought it was some sort of a spirit or an apparition. They cried out in fear. Jesus spoke up and said, don't be afraid. Be of good cheer. It's I. Don't be afraid. And Peter said, well, Lord, if it's you, let me come out there and meet you on the water. Jesus said, well, come on. So Peter came down out of the ship, and he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Then he looked around and saw the wind. It was blowing, the waves, and he got afraid, and he began to sink. And he cried out, and he said, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus reached forth his hand, caught him, and said, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? When they got in the boat, the wind ceased. Notice what happened. Verse 33, then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, of a truth, you're the Son of God. Of course Jesus could walk on the water. Of course the wind would still have fallen. Jesus Christ is the one who was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him. Without him was not anything made that was made. He's the one whose word called the sea into existence. By his word, he called the wind into existence. the water was subject to the Creator. You know, it's interesting. John tells us in John chapter 1 that he was in the world. The world was made by him, but the world knew him not. He came into his own, and his own received him not. Here was the Creator, unrecognized and unacknowledged by human beings whom he had made in his own image. The elements recognized him. The elements responded to his voice. Of course he could walk in the water. He made the water. The response, this is the first time you read of the disciples acknowledging him as the Son of God. They fell down and worshipped him as God. They had acknowledged him as the Messiah. They believed he was the Messiah. But you see, it took a little time for them to begin to really fully grasp who he was. They saw him walking on the water, and they believed that he was the Son of God, and they worshipped him. Now, in John chapter 20, we've already talked about the crucifixion, his blood poured out. They saw the blood poured out, and they also saw when Jesus appeared to them. John brings out in John chapter 20, he showed the disciples his hands and his side, John 20, verse 20. And they were glad when they saw the Lord. Thomas, of course, wouldn't accept their testimony and said, I'm not going to believe it unless I see it myself. And Jesus showed them his hands and his side. You know, you ever thought about it? The blood was all gone. The blood had been poured out. It wasn't, you know, a bloody wound. It was an open wound. It was where Thomas could have stuck his fist. You know, his blood was poured out. He wasn't living because he had blood pumping through his veins, because his heart was pumping blood. He was living through the power of God. It was spirit life. It was eternal life. It was the kind of life that you and I could have and can have through Jesus Christ. The same kind of life he has right now. John says, you know, God's witness is greater than any man's witness. And God gave special witness through the Spirit, and water, and blood. The Spirit came down and lit on him in the form of a dove. He walked on the water, poured out his blood, but his body alive and vibrant and glorious. The blood shed poured out on the ground and soaked in to pay for your sins and for mine. Jesus Christ is alive. John says, I've written these things and many other things that I could have written. Many other signs, John 20, verse 30, truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples. Things that aren't written here, these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. And believe it, you might have life. If you believe it, then you will act on that belief. And that belief will take you to life. So, the Apostle John had a very specific and special reason for writing long after everyone else had written, to demonstrate, to bear record, to testify of the things that Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, things that are signs that prove that Jesus Christ is Messiah, Son of God.